Good evening and welcome to the European Institute of the London School of Economics and Political Science. This evening it's my very great pleasure to be able to introduce José María Gil Robles Gil Delgado, who since January of 1997 has been President of the European Parliament. Of course, before that time, he did other things. Before that time, he worked for a very, very long period in the Spanish Cortes. And I think it's remarkable that he was both able to work at that time within Spain, having been born in exile, and of course being a scion of a very important political family in Spain. His father, as I'm sure you all know, José María Gil Robles Quiñones de León, was the first leader of the Confederación Española de Derechas Autónomas, the major Christian Democrat party before the Spanish Civil War. And after the Civil War, his father, and I know that Don José María here with us this evening was a powerful support to his father during those years, was a major protagonist in the struggle to re-establish a constitutional monarchy in Spain. Most notably, of course, through his presence at the great Munich Conference, the fourth Congress of the European Movement in June of 1962, which took place in Munich, when his father led a delegation of Spanish Democrats who met exiled Spanish Democrats in what in many respects was a kind of rehearsal for the peaceful democratic transition in Spain. Well, at that time, Don José María was actually working in the Spanish Cortes, which meant that his protagonism in that event had to remain rather more discreet. But with the coming of democracy, he came to prominence as a member of the Izquierda Demócrata Cristiano. The Izquierda Demócrata Cristiano was, of course, the principal Christian Democrat option of the various conservative parties that emerged during the transition to democracy. In 1989, he was elected to the European Parliament, has had an extremely active career there on numerous committees, which has been crowned, as I say, recently by his election to the presidency of the Parliament. We're very fortunate to have him with us here this evening, and he's to speak to us on the topic, a common task to seek our own advantage in the advantage of all. Don José María Gil Robles.
Thank you very, very much for your kind presentation. In fact, I would never thought that the night of or when my father and other members came from the Munich Conference and they were kept in the airport of Fronbrachas, prevented to come back home, I would never think that some years after, not so much in historical terms, because that was on 62, in fact, 35 years after, his son would be the president of the European Parliament and Spain would be a full member of the European Parliament, and I would be there speaking about our common interests, the interests for Europe. So I will thank warmly the European Institute of the London School of Economics for inviting me to give this speech in my first official visit. Not my first visit, of course, but for my first official visit to the United Kingdom. What I have to say falls into two parts. In the first, I should like to describe the basic principles which, in my view, should constitute the foundations of European integration. In the second, I shall review some of the main issues which will feature on the European agenda over the next months. However, before I begin, I should like to remind you of something which is frequently overlooked. None of the European institutions, and at least of all of them, the European Parliament, is external to the member states. The European Parliament is as much a British institution as it is a German, Spanish, or French one. It is an institution which belongs to each of the member states, and which represents that country's citizens. As its president, I am therefore speaking to you today as an European addressing other Europeans. UK political leaders usually describe their policy vis-à-vis the European Union in one word, which is pragmatism, meaning that their country's policy is not the product of abstract or ideological considerations, but is rather an attempt to protect their national interests. This general principle is what I believe has determined their position vis-à-vis the process of European integration. The United Kingdom has rarely demonstrated support for general ideas, but has always taken an interest in practicalities. The scepticism of the UK representative at the Messina conference is a good illustration of this. He told the negotiators that they would never reach an agreement, and then if they reach that agreement, if they did agree on a treaty, it would not be ratified. And in that, if it were ratified, the result will be disastrous. However, each time the United Kingdom has realized that the other European Union member states are successfully implementing a joint project, it has become involved in that project and supported it. For example, the United Kingdom did not originally believe in European political integration, preferring a pragmatic association of limited scope, the European Free Trade Association. But when it became obvious that the European Community, with its six original member states, represented a larger and more active trading bloc, the United Kingdom decided to join. I would say more, it struggled long for joining and made all the possible to join at the end as it joined. Another more recent example is that of the United Kingdom attitude to the plans for a single market. A customs union already existed, but free trade was hampered by so-called technical barriers. President Delors took the view that a lengthy process of harmonizing standards should be replaced by a mutual recognition scheme in order to create an integrated market more quickly. I would observe that this idea was supported by Mrs. Thatcher, whom nobody will regard as an enthusiastic of the big Europe. I think, nonetheless, that she took the view that a single market would serve the United Kingdom's national interests, and she was very much in favor of it. Otherwise, it couldn't have been done as it has been. I am going to say something which may disappoint some of you, perhaps. Pragmatism with regard to European integration is not specific of the British. This idea has been the hallmark of the entire process of European integration from the start. We all know, as Schuman used to say, that Europe will not be built in a day, nor as part of some overall design. It will be built through practical achievements that first create a sense of common purpose. I sometimes compare it with a tissue, which we must do knot by knot, and which is more and more tight as at the moment that we are making more and more knots, it is having more and more density. In that tissue, none of the member states' governments ever loses sight of its national interests. It could hardly be otherwise. Those involved are responsible politicians elected by their fellow citizens, to whom they are answerable. Nothing will be done in Europe against the wishes of the member states or their citizens. In the words of a Spanish bullfighter, of course Spanish, but it could be also Latin America, famed for his forthright speaking, what cannot be, and furthermore, it's impossible. The differences are stylistic and lie in the way these things are approached and presented. Most continental political systems are based on coalitions. This means that when constituting governments, politicians are used to negotiating agreements and reaching a consensus. This is perhaps more difficult in the United Kingdom. Not only in the United Kingdom, there are also other European countries with the same culture now, since the electoral system means that a single party normally enjoys a great parliamentary majority. It was no coincidence that the six founder member states of the European Community were led by coalition governments. Most of the member states present their policy on European integration by seeking their own interests through the general interest. This does not mean renouncing any genuine national interest. On the contrary, it is an imaginative, creative approach seeking to arouse the interests of the other member states in proposals which are of mutual benefit. The spirit is what Jean Monnet called for from the delegates to the first intergovernmental conference in 1950. I quote, "We are here to accomplish a common task. I said not to negotiate our advantages, but to seek our own good in the good of all." And Monet memories then add, "The 60 delegates present did not know that they were to hear me repeat that lesson for more than 10 months, one of the most difficult lessons to learn for those who have been educated in the defense and conquest of purely national interests." Well, 47 years after, we are still repeating that lesson, and we must repeat it every time. And when it is not enough heard, we have results like those of Amsterdam, which has been a too short step for what we would like to have at that time. So the lesson must never be forgotten. Where do these considerations take us? To a very simple conclusion. Within the Union, the only way to defend national interests effectively is in the medium and long term is to turn them into common interests, that is, to express them in terms of a shared advantage. Of course, in short terms, you can block or you can veto decisions. It's not sustainable in the long run. In the long run, you must turn to the other way to defend their own interests. The lesson to be learned from the half century which has elapsed since Monnet made that remark I quoted earlier is that our search for the common interests must be based on a small set of guidelines. I am trying to explain shortly these guidelines. The first of these is that the European Union has to act for people. The action of the European Union and through it the action of its member states must be made legitimate by the citizens. It must have the support which will only be granted if they can see that such action is useful and beneficial in their everyday lives. Countless examples of this could be given, which does not mean that they are always given. Sometimes it's our fault that we don't communicate enough and we don't explain enough. From programs arising in regions of zones which require aid, the structural funds, to rules on sell-by dates for products, the welfare of animals, or students' exchanges, or the very big question of the mad cow. People support when they think that we, the European Parliament, are doing for them something which is useful. It turns away when he thinks it's a not useful expense. All these very numerous technical decisions have enormous economic consequences. The existence of a single market implies that there ought to be a certain amount of coordination in the member states' economic policies, and it will have it. The Treaty of Amsterdam foresees economic guidelines each year, which will be the framework for national economic decisions, as you know. In order to prevent the trees from letting us see the wood, the European Parliament needs to be able to exercise general democratic control over the Union's major economic policy guidelines, and we are, in fact, now negotiating with the Council the possibility of having this control, of having something to speak between the proposals of the Commission and decision of the ECOFIN and the heads of Member States. This need for legitimacy leads to the second principle. if it is to be supported by the general public, the European Union has to be comprehensible. To be comprehensible or understandable, it has to be simple to understand, and it is essential that we keep it simple. I do not believe that we need to be particularly creative in this area. The European institutions should be few in number and have a clear, definite role. An European Parliament, a Council, a Commission is the general framework of member states. The only problem is it is enveloped in such a difficult language and such a variety of treaties now that go one after the other that it's practically impossible to citizens to understand anything. That's why now our Legal Affairs Committee of the European Parliament has begun to work on having a consolidated and more clear version of that task, which must be done with European national parliaments, but which is essential to bring the Union closer to the citizens. However, legitimacy also stems for efficiency, and this leads to the third principle. The institutions need to operate properly. We have to make the machine work. It needs to be able to take decision at the appropriate time and ensure that those decisions produce an effect. Here, the procedure for institutional reform, which has been followed until now, has been the Intergovernmental Conference, whose limits have now been clearly demonstrated. When the European Parliament calls for the institutional reform to be completed, a job which was half done in Amsterdam, it is not because it enjoys constant discussion about reform, but because it is essential that the decisions are not blocked or take too long to reach. It means we need much more majority decisions and much less possibilities of veto. It is very difficult for 15 member states, and there will be more of them in the future, in the near future, to reach unanimous agreement. It was easier when we were six. It was more difficult with nine. It's nearly sometimes impossible with 15. Imagine what will happen when we will be 20 or 25. A procedure similar to the normal legislative procedure would appear to be more constructive and more practical to put in work, and Parliament is strongly pushing ahead. The need to guarantee a simple institutional framework and to ensure that it works well leads us to the conclusion that before trying to be creative, we have to be practical. The European Union institutions, which have their roots in the rich diversity of Europe, have enough flexibility to enable them to adjust to a changing world. In this connection, it is worthwhile recalling how the roles of the European Parliament, the Commission, and the Council have been progressively adapted to the model of parliamentary democracy. In spite of all the declarations and technical proposals, we should not forget that on a day-to-day basis, practical solutions have been sought, for example, the institutional agreement on the budget reached at Amsterdam. Perhaps I shall explain that. In Amsterdam, we found that the Council was extremely reluctant to let us have budget decisions on foreign policy because they thought we could influence that. They simply tried to make a paragraph avoiding that. We couldn't win a frontal fight and go just against the Council. So we had to find a compromise. We found a compromise so that we will accept now that there will be very broad lines in budget, but the Council can have quite a lot of possibilities of acting inside these broad lines, but we retain our political power. In the same way, now we are pushing ahead with the responsibility of the Commission against Parliament, as any other parliamentary government, and we are obtaining that relations between Commission and Parliament are more and more in the line of any parliamentary government. It's something which is done in practice. It's sometimes things that can't be only or are not necessarily being done by a treaty. This necessary flexibility does not imply that there are no rules, not even unwritten ones. The European Union cannot function, and indeed it would dare to say that it could not exist, unless there is cooperation and mutual support amongst its members. I am sure that in the country which invented fair play, everyone can be asked to play by the rules. This does not mean that everyone will agree with everything. All it means is that when somebody joins the union, it needs to know that it's not a straightforward common market or other free trade forum, but a community which accepts the goals laid down in Article 1 of the treaty, that of creating an ever closer union amongst the people of Europe. New members need to know that they have to play the game according to the rules, sometimes old members also, without seeking to put the brakes on the development of the union by adopting systematically negative attitudes towards that ever closer union of which the treaty speaks. Before concluding this part of my speech and going on to talk quickly, of course, about the immediately future, I should like to describe the last of the principles on which our thoughts about the European Union should be based. We may well all agree that small is beautiful. This means that we all wish to preserve what goes to make up our regional or national uniqueness, and we therefore wish to preserve our traditions, our culture, our language, and so on and so. But in an increasingly smaller, more integrated, and more interdependent world, we have to ask ourselves how best we achieve this objective. By world standards, all the European Union member states are already small, or will be by the beginning of the next century. We should bear in mind that in 2025, no European state will appear on the list of the 25 most populated countries in the world. If we wish to continue being what we are, the largest area of democracy, prosperity, and mutual support of the world, we should unite in order to face challenges from the outside. Only in this way will we be strong enough to preserve our unique characteristics. The same holds true for the regions and for Europe. The regions within the large European member states increase their power and weight by being part of this larger whole. You may begin to notice it now. We have now 20 years experience about regions. You will begin now. Other countries have more long experience. In any case, if regions were to act on their own, their weight vis-à-vis the Union would be minimal. Great Britain or Spain can block an agreement. Scotland or Catalonia never could. Even some member states have found it more effective to combine, such as the Benelux. That means that what sometimes we heard speaking about the Europe of regions as Europe opposed to Europe of nations or Europe of states is a dream which is impossible to realize. It would be the end for peculiarities, the end of our way of living in each of the nation states. Well, now let us go to the topics of current interest which we will feature on the European agenda over the next few years. I hope I'm not going too late. The first topic is that of employment. We need to guarantee that guidelines for employment policies and the major economic policy guidelines are consistent and mutually reinforce one another. All community policies can and must contribute to that great objective. National realities vary greatly from one member state to another, but a proper system of evaluation and exchange of information could help us to adopt measures to get us out of the current crisis. The European Parliament has supported the establishment of employment convergence criteria proposed by the Commission. Unfortunately, the debate has polarized on whether these criteria should take the form of numerically quantified objectives or not, when the core question ought to be how to mobilize all those involved to work out a more aggressive employment policy. a policy which would include certain guidelines laid down by the common consent of the European Union, certain objectives laid down by Europe as a whole and adjusted to the real situation of each member state, and finally a method of verifying where they are being met. What matters is setting things in motion. That is, fortunately, what the Luxembourg Council, with some common sense, has done. In 1971, the representatives of the member states approved the Werner Plan, which was to have allowed us to achieve, 20 years ago, the economic and monetary union. We are arriving only now. It may have appeared to be merely a dream at that time to talk about economic convergence criteria. Nonetheless, today, those criteria have become a reality, and an operational reality, of course. In the same way, the idea of laying down specific objectives with regard to coordinated unemployment policy today may appear over-ambitious, and yet tomorrow it could be a fully operational and useful method applied by everyone. In the meantime, the Council has put into operation a multilateral surveillance system, which is not perfect at the outset, but which will allow us gradually to improve cooperation in this area. All of this should be done within the framework of a flexible and job-generating economy. This flexibility should also embrace the labour market, particularly by means of a social dialogue, which should take place at all levels, from individual companies right up to the European Union. In order for the economy to generate employment, it is also essential to complete finally the internal market, encourage an entrepreneurial spirit, devise tax reforms which do not penalize job contracts and employment, and above all, support small and medium size undertakings. Let us not forget that the latter play a fundamental role in job creation. The figures speak for themselves. In the last 10 years, small and medium size undertakings created approximately 80% of the employment generated in the private sector. For that reason, it would be appropriate to adopt horizontal measures to enable these undertakings to benefit to the full from the internal market. The European Parliament has adopted at first reading the European Union's budget for 1998, which places at the Council disposal 150 million ECU to fund the different budgetary lines on the Amsterdam Treaties chapter devoted to employment and innovation. In itself, this amount of funding will solve little. We are perfectly aware of that. But the decision to use it constitutes clear proof that there is a will to exploit all the means available to us. It's also a clear message to the Council. There's always possibility of reallocating funds to priority questions like employment. The second topic I would like to touch is the monetary union, which has given rise to a particularly lively debate and continues to do so. In this debate, many, perhaps too many things are said and written. I think it would be helpful to bear in mind a few simple facts. A currency is primarily a mean which of use to the general public and which enabled our civilization to emerge from the bartering practices which blocked any kind of economic development. There is no doubt that in all the member states, the currency is also important as a national symbol, more important, of course, to some than to others. Why do we need, then, a single currency? Because it represents a logical step in the creation of a single market. The European Community came into being as a custom union. We did away with one type of barrier between the member states. The Single Act made it possible to remove the technical barriers relating to manufacturing and safety standards. The third barrier, which still exists and which undermines the single market, is the monetary barrier. It is not normal that competition between European Union companies should depend on the fluctuations on the various currencies. I think I do not need in a London School of Economics to explain how it works. what I must say is that all these hinders the full development of the internal market and therefore affects economic growth and employment. It seems to me that it would be much better if companies were to invest rather than waste time and money fighting against monetary barriers. This is how businessmen see it too, and they therefore see the immense practical value of European Monetary Union, which no one doubts now that will be put in practice next May by the two. Next spring, then, there will be two decisive steps to be taken. The selection of the countries able to take part in the third stage of European Monetary Union and the appointment of the future president of the European Central Bank and the other members of the Executive Board. The treaties stipulate that Parliament should be consulted before each of these decisions is taken. Through their representatives, European citizens will be able to find out what criteria have been used to select the countries which will take part in the single currency in 1999 and who will be responsible for the Union's monetary policy. I can assure you that our Parliament now has trained in himself in the auditions we have had to the monetary institution until now to do this job, to have clear auditions to the future members of the board, to examine them, their independence, their integrity, their professional capacity, so that we can give an opinion, a serious opinion, that I'm sure the heads of government will take in mind and which will illustrate of the citizens about the kind of preparation the future members of the board have. In these matters, democracy cannot be pushed aside for the sake of some misguided notion of efficiency. I am perfectly aware that your country has an opting out clause on that subject, but the European Parliament represents the citizens of all the member states. United Kingdom MEPs will be therefore consulted and will contribute to the decisions and the control of the euro in all the forms I have spoken of. As regards the enlargement process, which is another of the topics I think it's necessary to touch, I believe that these principles may also help to clarify matters. On the need for enlargement, there is widespread agreement. Since 1989, the conviction has been growing that this is an historic challenge, the conquering of which is vital to our future and to that of all Europeans, both within and outside the Union. In the interests of our own security, we must consolidate the new democracies in the applicant countries and at all costs prevent a fragmented Europe, a divided Europe. We must give all these countries a clear signal that the process of accession is underway and that it is underway for all countries, although the rate of progress may vary to cater for individual circumstances of each country. This means that we need a dialogue with all these states which want to engage in talks. But the dialogue needs to be adjusted to meet what is really feasible for each country. Think of Russian dolls. The biggest one, that is to say, the most general kind of talks, needs to involve every single participant. As the dialogue becomes more intensive and more detailed, the size of the halls decreases. We have fewer participants. I am therefore convinced that the future European Conference will have to involve all the European countries which so wish at the highest level. However, it must be made clear that the intensity of the dialogue will vary according to its composition. As regards the actual accession negotiations, matters are quite clear and there is no need to complicate them. The negotiations are bilateral negotiations between the European Union and each applicant country. They are all equally worthy, but their problems, concerns and requirements differ. There's nothing worse than giving everyone coffee when some people would rather drink something else. However, everyone must be offered something. The European Parliament has been underpinning this dialogue with the associate countries for years through the work of bodies, searches, its interparliamentary delegations and joint parliamentary committees. Furthermore, periodic meetings are held with the presidents of the parliaments of the Central and Eastern European countries. Like all the other challenges which we have overcome during the last century, this one must be met with the same philosophy which helped the Union become what it is today. Nevertheless, it will be necessary to follow negotiations step by step. That means that this common interest cannot be created at the cost of losing or undoing the ties of solidarity which have grown up over almost half a century of painstaking community construction. Enlarging the Union at the cost of jeopardizing the policies on which cohesion is based will be a huge mistake and a disastrous change of direction compared to previous enlargements. Always, any enlargement has been to acquire the acquis communautaire, to accept policies which the Union has been building so difficultly. Never an enlargement has been done cutting down policies established. The revision of the financial perspective must banish this threat once and for all and guarantee all Europeans, both present and future, the certainty that what has been achieved so far will be preserved. The acquis communautaire equals makes the Union attractive to those which are not yet members. Ladies and gentlemen, I am finishing. The common task to which the title of my speech refers is that of European integration, the task of building Europe. Together we can successfully seek the strength, prosperity and peace we can no longer guarantee separately. Let us not look back like Lot's wife, but rather look forward and let the driving force behind what we do be not nostalgia, but a commitment to a living future. A glorious past will always be a source of pride, but that pride in the past must fuel a commitment to the future. The past will not be allowed to become an anchor that keeps the ship of state in harbor while the winds of history are blowing on the high seas. I am sure that the UK will take his place at the steer, will help to steer that common ship on the future, on making a future for all Europeans that will be a much better one, a much peaceful one. Thank you.
The President has very kindly agreed to answer questions, and after that virtuoso display of pragmatism and idealism, I'm sure there will be a number of questions from the floor, or indeed from the balcony.
I think the Union has a double legitimacy. One is the one established by the democratic elected governments which meet in the Council. And of course they are accountable to their national parliaments and they must continue to do so. The other one is the parliament which make the institutions accountable to to the whole of the citizens of the Union directly. Well, it happens that in majority decisions in the Council, accountability to national parliaments is not enough, because there's no possibility that a national parliament say you don't sign or you don't approve or you don't vote for that measure. You will be put in minority, and his government may stay to what his parliament has said, but being minority, that's not a democratic control. The only way to do it is with some institution that can hire and fire the institution what he elects, which is the executive, the commission. So we don't try to control the council. The council has its own controls. We try to control the commission, which is the one we execute, which applies the law, the democratic law, and we try to control the approval of these laws through the procedure of co-decision. That's our goal, and that's like the system in fact works. And when sometimes, more often than not, some members of national parliament say, but we will control the council and our governance. I say, all right, but you can be put in minority, and in any case, we will control it better if we do it in collaboration than if we take it like rivalry. I don't want to have rivalry with any national parliaments, and in fact, the European Parliament has very good contacts, and now is offering national parliaments to send them the documents earlier than their own governments, and we are doing that because now we begin to have email and internet system, and we can send them all the documents from the commission that we have quicker, and all the green papers and the white papers that governments normally don't send. Second point, how can we improve powers of parliament? In two ways. Someone has the control on economic guidelines. We don't have to change the treaties. It's not necessary. The only thing we need is to push strongly ahead for an agreement, what we call an interinstitutional agreement with Council. Why? In fact, we can do it without interinstitutional agreement. Last spring, Commission sent to the Parliament its proposals to the ECOFIN. And Parliament, of course, discussed them and produced a resolution. But we think it must be more practical and more effective if it's done in agreement with the Council than if we have to do it without agreement with the Council, because we will be officially seized, there will be an official consultation, and when a Parliament is officially seized and has an official consultation, he's always more responsible than when he has to act in his own initiative. That's why that's the way where we can have quite a lot of control. On the same way, we have prepared the control on the economic and the monetary policy, which does not mean that we are going to give instructions to the European Central Bank. Not at all. We are not thinking about that, nor trying to do that. It will be really a mistake. What we are thinking is what we could say a control by information. Be practical, what the American Federal Reserve does with the Congress of the United States. It means that each year you have a full comprehensive report of the USA Federal Reserve, in that case of the European Central Bank, and a discussion in the Parliament of these big monetary policy decisions. And that's been done. Now, with the European Monetary Institute, we have been putting in practice this system and really making the system work, because it's not something which can be done immediately. And the tradition of many of the European Central Bank governors is completely different. But now they are being happy to come to the to the Parliament and explain their policies and having a good dialogue with people, which is really practical in that question, and with a great deal of knowledge, and that allows them to make also publicity of their decisions. The same we will do with the Central European Bank. And we don't ask more. Only when there's important decisions, the European Central Bank will be the first interested to come and go to the Parliament and explain why he has raised rates of interest, or he has made some changes in the rates of actions with country currencies or so and so. That's the way we try now, especially to work. Of course, there would be an interinstitutional conference before the next enlargement is quite sure. There are more and more countries saying that it's absolutely necessary and Parliament has asked so. But for the moment, we are working on that line. Well, question of accession of Turkey is not a simple one. Why? Because in Europe you must have a democratic system to be inside. It has been asked to every country, Spain and Portugal. It was absolutely clear. They couldn't come when they had dictatorships. So you must be a system which is democratic and stable. Second point, that means that you can have a situation where there's the risk of having an integrist state, or to avoid that risk, you may have a military dictatorship. You can't so hurry Turkey coming into the Union until these two risks have been completely discarded. I think that's the first point. It's not a problem of being a Muslim integrist. It would be the same if there were Christian integrists. It's the same. You need a democratic society which is where there's no risk of having an integrism of any kind at any moment. Second point, still in the Turkey status on human rights is very poor. An European Parliament has asked from time and time that they improve that situation. Unfortunately, we don't reach that improvement. We don't obtain that improvement. That's why the European Parliament in the last budgets has blocked the credits to Turkey and say we put them in the reserve. We are only allowing credits for humanitarian actions. The other one will be unblocked if there's a progress in third and last. The question also with Turkey is the question of relation of Cyprus occupation. Before that question is not solved in a way where all parties of Cyprus can decide freely and democratically where they will come, I don't see any possibility to having Turkey in the Union. So you see that's big obstacles. That does not mean that we can let Turkey alone, because inside Turkey there are forces that struggle for all these objectives that I have spoken, even if there are others which struggle clearly against. So we must help the first ones and against the others. What Parliament is proposing is to have Turkey in the most broader Russian puppet. It will see in that conference where a dialogue, not negotiations, but a full dialogue would be maintained. Turkey and all the other applicant countries. Of course, when we speak about negotiations, it's necessary to fulfill all these criteria I spoke, that, and if Turkey goes quickly on that direction, we can never say it will not come to the Union, and it will be very bad if we give the sensation that Turkey will never come to the Union. We must give the sensation just the other way around, that they will come when they fulfill the conditions, which are not conditions for Turkey. They are conditions for everyone.
Do you think the gap barrier between the European institutions and the citizen can be achieved without European parties?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Yeah. Do you think that the dialogue you talked about between the citizens and the European institutions can be achieved without European parties?
Well, I would say it's more difficult. This dialogue is always difficult. Why? Because European institutions are far away, perhaps not in distance. They are far away from Malaga, and they are far away from Brussels, even from the citizens of Brussels. They seem something very far away, with a very difficult language and difficult to know how they decide. That means that we need links. It's not only a matter of communications, of making language simpler, which will help, but it's that we need links. Of course, a very powerful one is the European political parties. Well, something has been improved in that line. I begin to the EPP, which began some many years ago, and we have strong discussions inside, which is making a political common culture coming from very different origins and ways of thinking. The party of the socialists came some years before, 3 or 4 years before, 5 years before, that it's after some years after EPP, but they are doing the same exercise and having the same problems and going on the same way, and also for liberals. So I think that something, a reality which is dynamic, it's evolving now. What I would add is that it is not enough to have European political parties stronger and clearer. I think it's necessary also a strong work of the European NGOs. European Parliament, we are finding that NGOs are perhaps our best allies and our best helpers. When we prepared the last intergovernmental conference and we prepared our position for Amsterdam, we had two auditions with 300 European NGOs. They were extremely helpful. They gave us quite a lot, not only of ideas, but of citizens' feelings, because they came, it was an enormous wide range. Since European movement until some NGOs which came for a zone of a big city or some of the big cities in Europe. And so a very wide scope, very wide interests, but very helpful to us. We have had another after Amsterdam to know what will be their feelings to our opinion that we have to go to give and to the ratification. And we will follow also in this way. And we are following also in another committees to special and very concrete subjects. So we must combine two things, political parties and NGOs. It's the only way of having a link with citizens, which in any case, I will answer you, it's not enough now. It's necessary to work very much on that line.
Could I ask you to go a little further with something you said in your talk? You stressed the importance of enlargement, but you stressed that enlargement does not endanger existing policies of the cohesionist base. And
yes.
You went on to say that the revision of the fiscal perspectives must ensure that these policies which apply to existing members are open to future members.
Yes.
Would you like to take that a bit further? Because the obvious implications might be that respecting the convergence criteria of the Maastricht Treaty would be rather difficult for some existing member states if the fiscal perspectives take us far beyond the 1.3% of GDP, which is commonly talked about. And it seems to me that you're suggesting a very expensive spending policy.
No, I am suggesting a different spending policy. That means that if we give priority to the enlargement, we have had a reallocation of resources. When you have different priorities in a government, you change. If you have to, you may spend more or you may spend different. What I don't accept is the point of view to saying we will have a double Europe with the same money, because no one can really think that is credible. It's not common sense. No one would say, I'll double the size of my family and I will spend the same. It doesn't mean you must spend double, but you surely you may spend more. So we must reallocate our resources to say what we are spending today. Of course, there are some questions that sometimes are not taken in mind, because normally we tend to speak about enlargement as if tomorrow all the 15 would come and we had to double resources or pay much more. It's not like that. It's not like that by some reasons I'm trying to explain. First one, of the 15 countries, no one is prepared now. And they are pushing to come in 2003, 2004, which means that they are not sure at all that that would be feasible. I would rather think that it will take some years more for the first ones and many years more for the last ones. So it's an operation which will go more or less around 15 to 20 years. That means that increasing of spending is done in much more time. Second point, during this time we must hope that European economy is growing. In fact, Commission in his Agenda 2000 expects a growing of 2.5% a year, which would mean much more money for European attentions and European expenses. I don't know if it will be like that, and no one can know. European Parliament has said, let us accept it as a starting point. Just before the enlargement, we will see if it's so good or not. But in any case, some kind of expansion we must count for. Third point, enlargement is not a question of spending money. Even now, the applicant countries can't spend all the money we have for them, which is not very much. Why? Because the administrations are not prepared. It's not easy to spend European money. You have to be prepared to do so. You have to put money yourself. It's the principle of additionality. And so, even if we had enormous resources, they couldn't absorb them. That's another reason to go step by step. So I think the operation in a whole can be done more easily than we foresee now. In any case, I insist, some reallocation of resources must be done. But it has no sense that we will sacrifice our common agricultural policy. We can reform it. We must adapt it. That's quite clear. But we can't make it disappear. We can't make disappear all the structural funds. It will have no sense to help Hungarian underdeveloped regions or Romania and let the underdeveloped regions in the UK without help when it has been some years trying to develop. Cutting that abruptly would be a mistake, because all the money put there will be lost. So what we must have our goal is our underdeveloped regions inside the Union expand in these years enough not to need more structural funds. I am never for the culture of subvention. When I speak with people that say Spain will lose its cohesion funds, I say, what I would dream is that Spain in 3, 4, 5, or 10 years would never need more nor cohesion funds nor structural funds, because it would mean that we were enough rich to pay the others. The aim is not to be a country which must receive funds. The aim is to be a country that must pay funds, because it's that we are a prosperous country, not the other way around.
Well, I think on that extremely hopeful and optimistic note, we can bring the proceedings to a close. I hope you'll join me in thanking the President for his extremely lucid and optimistic vision of Europe and the common task that faces us all. Thank you very much.